I think there's been question about the duration of the power of attorney. The power of attorney. When the living will statute was first enacted, I think it had a 5-year duration. That is, a living will was effective for 5 years unless renewed. That was amended out of the law after a couple of sessions because people realized that people were forgetting about that. And when the time came to use it, lo and behold, it was too old. And yet they certainly intended that it be used, but they just hadn't returned to the subject because they'd done it once and they went on to other things. I think the same thing would happen here. It's like our wills. We have wills, and we look at our wills, we are usually shocked to find how long ago we signed those wills. Yet they're effective, and the law has decided that that's better than leaving people without a will. So a limited period of duration, I think, would dilute the intended effectiveness of this document. We provide in sub 3 of section 2 that the copy of the power of attorney shall be made a part of the principal's medical record when its existence becomes known to the health care provider. Question has been raised about who should have the affirmative duty to find a power of attorney for health care and bring it to the physician's attention. A good question. My inclination would be to encourage healthcare facilities to develop as part of their protocol when admitting patients to inquire about powers of attorney and directives to physicians. And if the patient says, yes, I did do this, then to see to it, to locate a copy. I think it would be an appropriate thing within the protocol of a facility. I'm a little hesitant to build it into a statute to require that facilities make that inquiry. Again, it's sort of the heavy hand of the law coming down and saying you shall do this. I don't feel terribly strongly about that, but I think that as this becomes more common in use in our society, that it will come to the facility's attention. They will make inquiry about it. When a person executes a power of attorney, it is prudent to provide one not only to the holder of the power, but to your physician, with a request that it be lodged in your medical record. And one would normally think to do that when you're thinking about signing one of these. So it will normally get there through that process and will be there when needed. I think that's enough on that, I think. Question was raised about the witness list for the power of attorney mirroring that in the living will statute. The power of attorney witness requirements are a little more liberal than the directive to physician witnessing requirements in that we, in the power of attorney bill, we only require one of the witnesses to be unrelated and have no possible interest in the estate, where in the living will statute we require that this be true of both of them. Earlier on, the group I worked with in developing this bill and in developing 672 had other amendments in 672, and one of those was to have the witnessing requirements mirror those which we now find in 523. In other words, we were going to liberalize witnessing requirements under the living will statute. We dropped those away because we just didn't want to have any more controversy with that one than we needed. So I think what we have here is a little bit more up-to-date thinking regarding the witnessing requirements in this bill, figuring that they are sufficient protection and facilitate the execution of the documents. Not quite as cumbersome as it would be if you had to have two witnesses who had absolutely nothing to do with you. Should the witness declarations be in writing? I think that's a good point. I think it was intended that they would be, but it doesn't specifically say that. I think it probably should. In line 28, page 2, should provide each witness shall make the following written declaration in substance. Okay. Section 3, sub 4, which carries over from page 2 to page 3, says if a power of attorney for health care executed in another state is valid in that state, it is valid in this state. And the dash 11 amendments would add subject to limitations imposed by this act, or imposed in this act. I have no trouble with that amendment if it's intended to apply to the use of the power of attorney. But I think that would apply anyway. If it's intended to impose the execution requirements on it, I would disagree. I think it's more important that we allow powers of attorney to be in use and trust that other states are going to be reasonably prudent about the way people sign those things, rather than to disqualify powers of attorney that may not precisely conform in all respects, such as the warning that we require, but some other state might not, for that document to be effective. I think that goes too far. I'd like to pause for a moment on section 5. Note that it says, subject to the right of the attorney in fact to withdraw, the acceptance by the attorney in fact creates a duty for the attorney in fact to make health care decisions on behalf of the principal at such time as the principal becomes incapable. It's important to note that. This is not something that should be taken lightly by either party. And the attorney in fact has picked up some obligations when he accepts that charge. We provide an easy out, notice to the principal, or notice to the attending physician, because we don't want, even though we recognize that after the principal becomes incapable for the attorney, in fact, to resign creates a vacuum, but nevertheless, we thought it better that that be allowed to occur than we have a reluctant attorney, in fact, if you will.
Senator, we discussed this briefly this morning, but rather than fall into that vacuum, the attorney in fact says I can't do this, I can't handle this, I can't make this decision, goes to somebody and withdraws. Should that somebody be a court in a guardianship proceeding so that you don't have a vacuum, so that the attending physician isn't sitting there at that point saying, oh great, now what do we do? Convene the family, convene the ethics board, convene the court maybe. Should a withdrawal trigger a guardianship proceeding? I know you're reluctant on the guardianship proceeding in other places in the statute. At this point, you've got a mess,
yeah,
to me. At this point, you've got an incapable principal. You've got an attorney, in fact, who's trying to withdraw. You've got a physician who's left in the lurch. And it seems to me that that's a real good time to bring a court in.
Could be. I guess you also have the situation which most families are going to find themselves in, which is that they haven't dealt with it, and you're back into that same sort of triumvirate of decision-making that we discussed earlier, one of which is to have somebody take the initiative to go to court to have a guardian appointed. And maybe it's just as well to leave it there, because that's really all it takes. If they see they've got a mess on their hands, then they can do that. Otherwise, they may think, well, we can handle this. You know, here we are. We're all the family.
And the physician, I suppose, also has the right to seek a guardianship.
I think so. Holly, maybe you know the answer to that.
Counsel, do you know the answer to that question?
Can...
Under existing law, does a physician have a right to seek a guardianship?
Statute reads any person.
Okay. I knew that any person could seek its revocation. I wasn't sure that any person could seek its institution.
Okay. Thank you.
Regarding the warning, which appears in Section 6, I know there are some suggestions of language to beef it up. I think it's important to bear in mind that we were trying to construct in this warning a readable document. This is not trying to reproduce the act within the warning. This is trying to be something that the person signing this document is going to stop to read and is going to understand it when he reads it. If you make it too long and too complex, most people are just going to say, that's a legal document, I give up. So I guess there may be some changes in it that are appropriate as amendments are made. I don't dispute that there might be, but I just hope you'll bear in mind that what we want to emerge here is with a document that will be used and that people will read and will understand. You'll note that the words in the warning don't always parrot the words in the statute. They're often used in a more colloquial sense. The warning is not the operative language. The statute is the operative language.
Chair? Senator, I noticed that in this warning, there's no invitation for a person to seek advice of counsel. Maybe I misread it, but I don't see it in there. And that runs all through the law. Would it make sense to, if you don't understand what's in here, you should seek an attorney's advice before you?
We do have that in the warning.
Okay, I missed it.
Line 39. If there is anything in this document that you do not understand, you should ask a lawyer to explain it to you.
I apologize.
Okay. But we do not require a lawyer to be involved, and that was deliberate.
That's fine. I missed that.
Section 7 is an important section because, of course, that is the one that provides the power. Unless the power of attorney for health care provides otherwise, the attorney, in fact, designated therein, has all the authority over the principal's health care that the principal would have if not incapable. It's been suggested that you add to that, subject to the limitations imposed by this act, and I have no problem with that. I do have a problem with inserting guardianship priority, and we've discussed that already. I really think that's inappropriate. Section 7, sub 4, which begins on line 14 of page 4, I think it's important to stop for a moment and reflect on what that one does. Attorney, in fact, has a duty to act consistently with the desires of the principal as expressed in the power of attorney unless otherwise made known to the attorney, in fact. If unknown, the attorney, in fact, has a duty to act in what the attorney, in fact, in good faith believes to be the best interests of the principal. It's been suggested by the Dash 11 amendments that we strike the good faith language and have it read, has a duty to act in the best interests of the principal. This is a very fundamental difference in the philosophy of this act. And I alluded to it earlier, but I want to return to it. Best interest of the principal is a paternalistic standard in which some court or third party decides what it or he believes is in the best interest of the principal. That's what we're trying to get away from. We want this to reflect what the principal wants. And the reason he selects someone else, if he doesn't spell out precisely the decisions to make, is that he trusts the judgment of that other person to, in good faith, act in what that person believes to be in the best interest of the principal. Substitute a judgment. Substitute the judgment of the attorney, in fact, for the principal.
Mr. Chair. Senator, I guess I want to go with this a little bit. It seems to me that what the Dash 11 amendments would do would be to take out the good faith standard as it applies to the attorney in fact, because the printed bill simply says the attorney in fact has a duty to act in what the attorney in fact in good faith believes to be the best interests of the principal. Now, it seems to me if you wanted to get at true substitute judgment, the language would be what the attorney in fact in good faith believes would have been the wishes of the principal. Now, that seems to me that would have been true substituted judgment, that the language in the printed bill is really a best interests standard already, but it muddies the water with the good faith of the attorney in fact. It seems to me if you really wanted substitute judgment, you'd say, okay, attorney in fact, in good faith, you make your best estimate as to what the wishes of the principal would have been. Now, I personally may not agree with that approach, but that seems to me that would have been substituted judgment language. And what you've got in there is really best interests language with a twist.
That's a good observation. Let me respond. I think that what would have been the desires of the principal would ask for some sort of clairvoyance almost, to try to divine what that principal would have wanted.
Which is substituted judgment anyway, I assume.
That's not such substituted judgment. That's not judgment at all. That's just, as I said, clairvoyance. You're trying to decide what the principal would have wanted, whereas
All I'm trying to get at is what was your intent in drafting this language? I'm not trying to argue with you about what the law should be. I'm trying to get at what lines 17 and 18 are supposed to say.
Okay. We want the attorney, in fact, to use his judgment about what he believes is in the best interest of the principal. The thought being that when the principal picked that person, the principal thought that person is going to come as close as anyone I can think of to do what I would have done, using that person's judgment, okay, what's in my best interest. I think the two may really be pretty much the same thing. They're very close.
Yeah, we're dancing angels on the head of a pin here, and it may be an important pin or it may not. But I understand what you're saying. You're trying to get at really a delegation of judgment.
Yeah.
Okay, world, if I don't have my judgment to rely on, next smartest person in the world I know of is Bob Shoemaker, and I want him making decisions for me, and I don't want anybody second-guessing his decisions.
Right.
That's really what you're after.
Yep.
And I don't want any questions about somebody else asking whether this is really in my best interest or not. What Shoemaker says goes, subject to other things that we're going to...
If he's off the wall, we can...
If he's drunk or if he's an emotional basket case or some other things.
Okay.
Just a lay observation is I'm not sure that the language in lines 18 and 19, or 17 and 18 does that. That would, my first reaction on reading it was that was a best interest standard modified by a good faith indemnification of the principle of the attorney in fact. So,
you could be right. I'm pretty close to this thing by now, and I may not see it with the same objectivity.
I do understand what you're trying to do, though. All right,
thank you.
Senator Shoemaker, it seems to me that there is a difference between the attorney in fact doing what they think is in the best interest as opposed to doing what the principal would have done. And I heard you say that a few minutes ago, and I don't think that's... I mean, the conclusion I think I came to was that I think what you had was right, but then I heard you say something about doing what the principal would have done. And I just think that's different. And I can imagine myself in a lot of instances, including this one, turning decisions over to somebody who's whose good judgment I trust. And in this case, I think there is, in fact, quite a significant difference between doing what is in the best interest as opposed to doing what they would have done if they had been there.
Yeah, I think there is. Let me back up a little bit in this section and point out where this comes into play. This is preceded by a sentence that says the attorney, in fact, has a duty to act consistently with the desires of the principal as expressed in the power of attorney unless otherwise made known to the attorney, in fact, at any time. So if you have anything that tells you what the attorney, in fact, would have done, that is what you're supposed to do.
You mean what the principal would have done.
Thank you. Then if the principal's desires are unknown,
sure.
I suppose we could say unknowable, then you go into this best interest according to the attorney in fact's good faith belief in that. Now, it's a subtle gradation there, and maybe we can work with the language a little bit to get closer to what both of you are speaking to, which I have no problem with conceptually.
Mr. Chair. No. He's supposed to chair a committee right now.
Our committee is perhaps convening at 3, but if so, I'll not be there. Also, I had a radio thing, which I won't be on, so we'll worry about that later.
Chairman.
Any minutes?
To the same point in the bill, Representative Clark and Representative Calori's question, the good faith standard as opposed to a reasonableness standard. It seems to me that when we're talking about a substitute judgment, the way that it's structured now with the in good faith kind of leaves it up to, I believe, just based on my experience and knowledge of this individual, that this is what they would have done, as opposed to what may or may not be reasonable. Wouldn't it be more prudent to put the word reasonably believes as opposed to in good faith believes?
Well, every time you put in the word reasonably, you invite a challenge, and you cast a seed of doubt on the person exercising the judgment and on the people that are responding to that.
But, Mr. Chairman, Senator, that's the exact point. There's a need to have a challenge. There's a need to be able to hold people who are attorneys of fact accountable for the actions that they take. And I feel uncomfortable with this language in good faith as opposed to reasonableness because of that. That's the issue.
Well, it's a judgment call. There is another portion of the bill where we have a fair number of in good faith standards that apply to people following a power of attorney for health care. And it's been argued that that should be changed to reasonably.
Line 21, page 5.
You started out by saying they want you to drop good faith standards, right?
Some do.
Some do. Well, the Dash 11 amendments, well, and I think the trial lawyers.
I'm looking at lines 26 and 27.
As a duty to act consistently with your desires, as stated in this document or otherwise made known, or if your desires are unknown, to act in your best interest.
I'm not trying to be technical or picky, but that language is unacceptable to you. 18 of page 4, is that right? Because you think it...
No. That language is fine. This warning, this is telling the principal that the person he picks as attorney in fact is to act in the principal's best interest if the attorney in fact doesn't know exactly what the principal would want in that circumstance.
Right.
And point is that the principal is picking a particular person to act in his best interest.
Right.
So you want that person to act in your best interest, but you have to rely on that person's judgment about what that is. That's why you pick him. And if you just have an objective best interest standard, as has been proposed for Section 7, you are immediately inviting challenge to every decision that the attorney in fact makes by somebody who does not think it's in the best interest of the principal because he's got a different set of value judgments that he operates by, different set of values. Sort of a different issue from the one that Representative Clark and Representative Clory and I were discussing. In other words, if you have a purely objective... Now, remember that the warning is not the operative language. This is communication to the principal.
I understand.
And that the subtle distinction we're talking about is the kind of thing that gets lost in verbiage.
But I guess also it's communication to the attorney.
Yes.
I can't believe that this language, some discussion, I would hope, is going to take place. This individual's being asked to do this. I assume,
absolutely.
Hey, why don't you come down and just whip off a little attorney off the machine. So I assume it's a very solemn, serious moment.
Has been every time I've been involved in one.
In the attorney's office or wherever you're going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
This point has to come up that while we know each other and we understand each other, if you get in a situation where you're unsure, just ask counsel, and we anticipate here that this is going to be a very simple, generic type of attorney. In fact, you're not going to laundry list the following types of things. I'm on dialysis, I'm on this, I'm on that. You're not going to go into that kind of detail. This good faith, best interest thing would be discussed, wouldn't it?
Should be. Yes.
I phase in, I phase out. Mm-hmm. I read you on the good faith standard for a few seconds, then I lose it.
Chair.
And what happens to me is I think they're close, and then you convince me they're not, and then I'm convinced they are. So I'm fading in and out on that. I can't get a handle on it.
Let me try again. Without regard to the warning, if the warning should be more consistent with the bill, that can be fixed. But the difference, if the attorney, in fact, has an obligation to act in the principal's best interest, period, and we don't know what the principal's wishes were in a particular situation, the attorney, in fact, makes a decision. Somebody says, I disagree. I don't think that's in the best interest of the patient. And the statute says you've got to act in the best interest of the patient. How do you resolve that? You can't. Perhaps you can resolve it in court, but I doubt it. You're kind of stuck. Whereas if you have what the attorney, in fact, is supposed to do is to act in his good faith belief of what is in the patient's best interest, when you come to that point in the road, the attorney, in fact, says, well, this is what I believe is in the principal's best interest. Somebody says, I disagree. Attorney, in fact, says, we talk about it, obviously, and say, well, I'm sorry, I do believe that that is truly in his best interest. I know you don't agree, I respect that, but I believe it is, and so therefore that's what we'll do. The language that we now have would support that, and the matter could go forward. If the other
got in there, that first of all, the person has been given a very unique and special power.
Mm-hmm.
Applies something to a court of law, it seems to me. Obviously, from an evidentiary standpoint, the relationship between the attorney, in fact, and the principal would be brought before the court. And for this individual to be making decisions as to why he or she thought it was in the best interest, I assume that the good faith burden would be there. find.
Right.
All things being equal. Now, I realize if we've got a scoundrel on our hands, well, all of a sudden we found it's one of the greatest liars in the history of the world. But, you know, I'm not, I just assume that that would be there. But anyway, I won't belabor it, Senator. I got thrown because the lack of the good faith standard in this warning, which I think, while it isn't the operative language, Senator, and you're right, it should be in bright, blazing orange and lemon color. I mean, maybe that's...
I think that might be... I think that might be fine.
Everybody on notice, yeah, of how serious and solemn, but also their duties, respect duties, because I think attorney, in fact, does have a heavy responsibility. They're going to take it very seriously, and they'd like to know what's expected of me in terms of those moments. That's the only reason I got a little bit thrown.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I also think there was some confusion about the good faith, reasonableness standard raised by Representative Menace's question, which has to do with the liability aspect. And that's those are a whole different set of issues.
Different set of issues.
This has to do with what duty are we putting on the attorney in fact, and what thought process is that person supposed to go through,
right,
under the terms of the act. And that's a different question from liability. Would you agree?
Yes, I do. Okay. It really is quite different. Let's see. Section 8, there are a number of amendments that have been proposed by both the Dash 11 amendments and by the OMA about adding some constraints to attorney in fact's authority dealing with withholding or withdrawing of life-sustaining procedures. I'm more comfortable with the OMA amendments in Section 8